This week on The Best of Flashpoints, internationally renowned author and essayist Arundhati Roy talks about her new book, Field Notes on Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers. Also, an in-depth look at the national healthcare crisis as single-payer becomes an endangered idea. Andy Bickelbaum of the corporate prankster activist group The Yes Men talks about the power of nonviolent creative civil disobedience against multinational companies, along with Antonia Juhas of Global Exchange. And Jewish-American poet Josh Healy discusses why he was disinvited to the J Street Conference in Washington after they learned about his pro-justice views on Palestine. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Arundhati Roy was born in 1959 in Shillong, India. She studied architecture in New Delhi, where she now lives. She has worked as a film designer and screenplay writer in India. Roy is the author of the very moving autobiographical novel, The God of Small Things, for which she received the 1997 prestigious Booker Award. The novel has been translated into dozens of languages worldwide. She has written several nonfiction books as well, including The Cost of Living, Power Politics, War Talk, An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire, and Public Power in the Age of Empire. Her newest book, published by Haymarket, is Field Notes on Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers. Roy is the recipient of the 2002 Lannan Foundation Cultural Freedom Prize. We reached Arundhati Roy at her home in New Delhi earlier today. We began the interview by asking her to talk about how democracy has been hollowed out, sort of commodified, to nurture corporate power instead of people's power.
Well, you've taken the words out of my mouth with your question. But basically, I think it's time that we realize that political systems, just like the global economy now, are not, cannot be just assessed by what countries do within their own borders. So, as you said, the big democracies in Europe, in America, Israel, India, are participating in or administering the most brutal military occupations. And these are a corollary to our democracies. So in India, Kashmir, India has an army of 700,000 soldiers, administering a tiny little valley. You can't move 10 steps without... I mean, a few years ago, you could see the AK-47. Now they are a little more subtle about it. But in fact, the army decides everything there, every single thing. When you inhale, when you exhale, is decided by the army. And, of course, administering military occupations is one part of it. But in a country like India, what is happening now is that, about in 1990, basically after the fall of the Berlin Wall and when capitalism won its jihad against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, India became a free market economy. And while it opened its markets to corporate capital, today the economy grew a huge amount, and obviously then we had our nuclear tests, and now India likes to parade as a superpower. But what has happened now, even as we speak, is that that growth rate, that GDP growth rate, has run aground because it was built on the back of India's poor. And it has led to an incredible deepening. While it's created a middle class, it's also led to a deepening of poverty and massive displacement. And now, we have Indian security forces surrounding the Dandakaranya forests of central India, where the indigenous people live, in order to kind of do a ground clearing operation, so that those forests can be turned over to corporates for mining. So really, you know, there's a report, in fact, a government report, which calls it the biggest land grab since Christopher Columbus. But so it's not just now military occupation outside of the country, but, you know, within, in the heart of the country, a kind of militarization, because that's the only way you can push these policies forward, because people are resisting them.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Christopher Columbus here. I'm calling you from San Francisco, and every year on what they call Columbus Day, we're treated to the Blue Angels. These are about six or, I don't know, eight or a dozen jets that spend 48 hours flying back and forth over the city, I guess, to celebrate Columbus Day. It is a venerated holiday here in the United States. Does that surprise you?
No, I remember coming to the U.S. and, you know, seeing the statue of General Amherst in, somewhere near Amherst University, and thinking, how can you have a statue of a man who distributed smallpox blankets infested with smallpox so that you wiped out, you know, hundreds of thousands of people with disease? But the thing is that these things are so blatant that they... You know, people don't even react to them. In India, you know, the middle class, which has just recently become middle class, recently got mobile phones and cars and so on, there's such a celebratory attitude here. So people are actually quite openly saying, you know, when you talk about the fact that you know, there are people just being murdered in the forest, you know, indigenous tribal people. And people actually turn around and say, look, every developed country, whether it's a European country or the U.S., has a past, and why shouldn't we? You know, it's, and then people just say it, then, you know, all your sort of bias talk about human rights and so on just flies out of the window, because they are like, so what? You know, this is how it has always been and how it must be. And so there's no argument left. There's only war, you know. So that's the sort of situation we are in now.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about Kashmir. It's a subject that we care a lot about on the Flashpoint show. We have a good friend of the show, Angana Chatterjee, who's written a book recently, Violent Gods. And she has been coming and going, trying to call attention to the unbelievable slaughters. In the summer of 2008, you were harshly criticized for your support of independence in Kashmir. Could you talk a little bit about why you support that, if you do, and say a little bit more about Kashmir, which is not, I assure you, and I'm sure you know, the favorite subject of the mainstream media here in the United States?
Yeah, well, you know, it's becoming increasingly, you know, on the one hand, increasingly simple, but on the other hand, you know, obviously the history of Kashmir is that it was an independent kingdom, and in 1947, when India and Pakistan were partitioned, both India and Pakistan sort of staked a claim to it, and it's now kind of divided into Pakistan-administered Kashmir and Indian-administered Kashmir. And, you know, right since 47, there's been a struggle for independence, which then turned into an armed uprising in 1989, 1990, following a brazenly rigged election. And now there's this occupation, which this struggle has claimed something like 70,000 lives and tens of thousands, 8,000 disappeared. I just should add that Kashmir is not the only place in India where these brutal battles are taking place, because there's also Manipur, there's also Nagaland in the northeast of India. But in Kashmir, now the real problem is Actually, my real worry now, which is a recent worry, is that, you know, America's intervention in Afghanistan, and I'm not talking about the 2002 intervention, I'm talking about, I'm talking about it from before. It's manipulation in Afghanistan and its attack on Iraq. All of this is now sort of the domino effect has come into Pakistan. Pakistan is struggling to survive as a country. And now I'm getting the distinct feeling that because the U.S. is under so much pressure from within to sort out Afghanistan, they are turning their eyes to India and hoping that somehow they can persuade India to send troops. I mean, this is just my speculation from what I'm signs that I'm seeing. To send some troops into Afghanistan, not as troops maybe, but as security for the embassy or some, you know, there'll be some sort of relief under which that could happen. And there's a lot of tension that's been ratcheted up between India and China now. And this talk about refurbishing the air bases on the borders. And my feeling is that the U.S. is preparing to use India as a fallback since Pakistan is in chaos, you know, and to bring the chaos that is created all over there into India. And meanwhile, India's, you know, war on its own people, which I was talking about earlier, the Maoists, the people they call the Maoists, who some of whom are Maoists, but most of whom are just indigenous and poor people fighting for their rights. So this, and of course we know what's going on in Sri Lanka. So there's a region that's spinning. It's in a tailspin, and this sort of public relations about the great democracy somehow is beginning to rock because for a long time, for most people, it has been a charade. Of course, it's a democracy for the Indian middle class, but it isn't very democratic for the rest. And now I'm worrying pretty seriously about all this. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I could be wrong. I mean, I could be being a bit paranoid. I hope I'm not. I mean, I hope I am. But the fact that these countries are all in big trouble is very obvious.
Well, so I would never use the word paranoid for Arundhati Roy because this is paranoid is unjustifiable fear. And certainly whether you're wrong or right, your fears based on history are justified. I guess in this context, maybe just mention, because people don't know in this country, haven't heard the phrase Operation Green Hunt. Talk about that in the context of these attacks and expanding attacks inside your country, I guess on the poor, on the disinherited, on the people who are already suffering the most.
Well, Operation Green Hunt is the name that the Indian government has given this overt sort of attack on what the Prime Minister 2 or 3 years ago called the greatest internal security threat to India, which is a Maoist insurgency in the forest, in the very mineral-rich forest. Now, the thing is, if you look at a map of India, the dense forests, the indigenous people, the minerals, and of course the Maoists are all there in the same place. But there's one more thing there which nobody talks about, which is the MOU. And this area is rich with bauxite and with iron ore, and also with a whole host of other things like tin and copper and so on. And the biggest mining corporations in the world have all got MOUs for steel factories, for prospecting licenses, for bauxite. I mean, the bauxite alone is worth something like $4 trillion, of which the Indian government just gets a small royalty. So what's happening is a situation like in Colombia or something, you know, like initially the people resisted the takeover of the land. Yes, there are Maoists in the forest, but the Maoists are the people, right? And then the government started funding and arming a tribal militia in some areas. Sometimes the corporates openly have their own militias. And there's a sort of civil war that began to spin out. And it's really funny because if you look at the dates on which these MOUs are signed, like there's an MOU with the Tatas, which is the biggest, one of the biggest corporations in India. And it's really days after that that the Salva Julum, which is the name of this tribal militia, government-sponsored militia, is kind of announced. That same year, a jungle warfare training school comes. Now we know that they've already identified sites for an air base, for a brigade headquarters. So the preparations for war, as well as the declaration of this internal security threat, came before it was a security threat. You know, there's a sort of self-fulfilling declaration. And now the operation is on, you know. So there's people are just being brutalized in the forest, and any of us who speak against it are being called sympathizers of terrorists or people who are creating a climate for terrorism. There are something like in this little state called Chhattisgarh, in a district called Dantewada, there are 644 villages that have been emptied by this marauding militia. Something like 300,000 tribal people are hiding in the forest with no food, no market, no health care, just living off the land. And this is what we call a democracy, you know. And meanwhile, these corporations are just waiting for their MOUs to be turned into hard cash. And of course, the media is fully involved in this. They just, you know, they invented overnight the stories of Islamic terrorism disappeared and Maoist terrorism is in, completely unsubstantiated stories. And if you argue, they'll just say, why don't the Maoists stand for elections? Which is, of course, the great sort of cure for everything in a democracy.
Yeah, like the one that just happened in Afghanistan. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
That one.
And in India, it's very interesting. You know, like the last general elections, the Indian political parties spent much more than in the U.S. elections, $2 billion. You tell me, where do they get that money from? $2 billion. And the majority of all the people who won the elections, meaning the members of parliament, are millionaires. The 99% of independent candidates lost. And now, you know, we are hearing this incredible scam about how the political parties and individual politicians have open deals with the mainstream media where they buy what are called coverage packages. You know, so it's like high-end, low-end, medium, and live coverage packages for millions of rupees. And you can buy, you know, 3 editorials, 2 front page pictures, and a live capsule on the 9 o'clock news for X amount or Y amount, you know? So it's just like no one can stand for elections unless they're backed by a corporate. And that money comes from, you know, it obviously comes from under the forest floor, from the iron ore and the bauxite and so on. So it's as if the rituals of democracy have just been completely hollowed out, become completely meaningless. And the dangerous thing is that it's not a dictatorship where some, you know, where some one person and the army are kind of holding everybody down. Here, it's seeped right to the bottom, you know, so it's like squelching now. This whole structure is weaving and squelching in a way that is very, very terrifying and has been completely exposed now.
And in terms of that terror, clearly women and children have taken a huge hit. Would you say that the oppressors have engaged in using things like rape as a tool of war?
Rape, of course, is internationally and historically always been used, but it's been used in Kashmir. It's been used almost systematically in places like Chhattisgarh. But the thing about rape, Dennis, is that before there was even this conflict, it was a matter of that the Indian feudal system is such that upper caste thought it was their right to rape lower caste women. Forest officials and police thought it was a matter of right to go into the forest and rape tribal women. So it's been there always, and of course now it's being used by the, you know, by the security guards and so on. But inside the forest, I mean, from what news one gets, inside the forest, the fact that there has been a political organization now has actually, I mean, a lot of the armed militia, more than 50% of the armed militia are women, you know. And so, in a way, that organization has in itself protected them and empowered them against these kinds of things, you know. So even if they lose this war against Operation Green Hunt, in the run-up to it, Much of the time is spent just reclaiming their dignity.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Arundhati Roy. Her most recent book is Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers.
It's actually called Field Notes on Democracy.
I'm sorry. Field Notes on Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers. And I was busy thinking about the grasshoppers and what they might have to do with all of this. Why that title?
That title comes from a lecture that I did in Istanbul. It was called Listening to Grasshoppers because it was a lecture on the anniversary, on the first anniversary of the assassination of this Armenian journalist called Harant Dink, who was shot outside his office in Istanbul for daring to talk about the Armenian genocide, which is a banned subject in Turkey. And I went to speak there, and my lecture was really about the kind of connection, historical connection between progress and genocide. And the title comes because a friend of mine, David Barsamian's mother, called Araxi Barsamian, who lived in Turkey at that time and was Armenian, spoke about how in her village, the wheat was growing and the storm of grasshoppers arrived, and the elders were very worried because they thought it was a bad sign. And then that summer, when the wheat ripened, the armed, Turkish militias arrived and killed everybody. And, I was talking about the fact that maybe they should have listened to the grasshoppers, and that now in India, a country that is poised on the precipice of progress, should we be listening to the grasshoppers, because this connection between progress and genocide is an old one. And if you examine the definition of genocide, is accepted by the UN, you'll see that it's not just a question of lining up people and killing them, but sometimes slowly starving them, cutting them off from their resources. And all of that is happening.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now turn our attention to the situation around health care, where the bill the, I guess you call it the Democratic bill, you want to call it that, is moving through the House. There's going to be a vote soon, and we wanted to take a look at it. I want to start with this sound from Donna Smith. She is an organizer with the California Nurses Association. She's based in Washington, D.C. She was featured in Michael Moore's film Sicko, and she essentially went back to do a little review of how the people in Sicko are doing. Listen to this.
If you really want to reform healthcare, really take the president's brave and wonderful statement as a candidate that healthcare is a basic human right, we can do it. Representative Anthony Weiner is offering what's called a substitute amendment, and his amendment would substitute the language of single payer, everybody in, nobody out healthcare, for some of the language in the bill right now. Do you want to become sickos in the future? If not, then we got to fix this in the right way. Thank you.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That was the voice of Donna Smith. She's a community organizer with the California Nurses Association. She's based in the Washington, D.C. area. She joins us from there. Also joining us is Chuck Idelson. He is a spokesperson for CNA. We wanted to have on Cindy Young with CSEA. This is the union that represents everybody who's not a teacher within the school system in this state, but she had to go to a meeting. Later on, we'll be joined by Daniel Hodges. He was at an action that took place at Nancy Pelosi's office yesterday to protest her role in the sort of the current legislation that's being considered. So let me start with you. We heard your voice on the tape, Donna Smith. According to listening to that, it doesn't sound like this new legislation is going to do it for the people who really need it.
No, and Dennis, thank you for having me on. That is basically the concern that so many of the patients of this country have, and certainly the nurses of the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee, that we're fixing a whole lot with this legislation. But what we're not fixing is some of the core problems that are causing patients to not be able to get the treatment and the care that their healthcare professionals feel is right for them and appropriate for them. It's not protecting citizens from facing bankruptcy. The leading cause of bankruptcy in this country by a high percentage is caused by medical crisis. And the legislation is not going to keep that from happening to families. So for people like myself and for the thousands of nurses that are in our association, we're very concerned about what this legislation still leaves open and it leaves undone.
Chuck Idelson, tell us a little bit about what the Democrats are saying in terms of why they're so anxious to commune with Republicans, or is it just the fact that they're all owned by the companies?
Well, yes, that's a large part of the problem, Dennis. I think as most of your listeners know, and you probably talk about it regularly, corporate power in Washington is the dominant force, whether the Democrats or the Republicans are running the government. And obviously there are differences between the Democrats and the Republicans, but when you look at basic issues such as health care, you have to take into account the enormous influence of the insurance lobby, the drug companies, the medical suppliers. Healthcare corporations are the number one spenders in corporate influence. They have topped federal lobbying every year for the past decade. They're spending something like $2 million a year, $2 million every day, on lobbying around this health care bill. So it's not a shouldn't be.
Did
a great
you say
surprise.
$2 million every day?
Something like $1 to $2 million every day that is being spent on lobbying on these bills before Congress. So it shouldn't be any great surprise to us that the bills tend to favor the status quo, and in particular protect the power of the insurance lobby and the drug companies.
And Donna Smith, let me just put myself out on the line here. I've had serious open heart surgery. What if I get fired from Pacifica tomorrow, lose my health care? Am I going to have an easy row under this new legislation, getting the coverage I need without a job?
Well, they'd certainly like you to believe that, wouldn't they? They tell you, you know, don't worry, you'll be able to go into this great insurance pool and purchase a policy, and they'll have to take you because of pre-existing condition, and won't it be wonderful? But here's the rub, is that an insurance company may have to take you, but it says nothing about what they can do with you once you're one of their policyholders. They can still deny treatments that you may need, and as someone who's got issues with your heart, you know how difficult that can be and how time-sensitive that can be, obviously, to have to quarrel and struggle with an insurance company. And one of the things we're very concerned about is as if they have to take everyone who comes to them as a customer and cover people with pre-existing conditions, they're not going to look at losing an awful lot of profits under this legislation. They're still going to want to make money. And one of the best ways they make money right now is to deny treatment and deny care. I think we'll see more denials, not less, under this legislation. And as a patient, that troubles me a great deal. We won't often know why we're being denied something, and at just the point when you're the most vulnerable and most need to get care, you have to launch into this terrible fight with an insurance company. So no, I don't think, you know, I feel like people will be less likely to want to change jobs, to change policies. You know, they tell you another fallacy. They tell you if you like what you've got, you can keep it. Well, that is just not true. Tomorrow, as much as you may like what or not like whatever you have through Pacifica, Pacifica might need or want to change who offers insurance for that company. You might have to change policies. Your insurance company may decide to change which providers they contract with, and you won't be able to make those choices. You may lose your job, and you may have to go get other coverage. So the last person in this scenario who gets to keep what they've got, if they like it, is the patient. So that is just not true, what we're being told, and that really troubles me.
Chuck, if you had 5 minutes with Pelosi, well, first of all, tell us the role she's playing, and then what would you tell her about what's wrong with the legislation?
Well, part of the problem of what's wrong with the legislation is that it's... They obviously compromised from the outset, as many people have noted. If they had done, anyone who knows anything about bargaining, for example, knows that you start from your strongest position, which, as everyone should know, would have been single payer or Medicare for all. Rather than do that, they began compromising with themselves before they began even talking to the Republicans or the insurance industry. So they offered limited a vision to begin with, and then they started bringing in the Republicans, the insurance industry, the drug companies, the biotech industry, all those corporate players, while they were actually excluding single-payer folks, nurses and doctors and the tens of thousands of grassroots single-payer activists all over the country, from participating in that process. So they came up with a bill which does have some positives to it, and there's obviously different versions in the House and Senate. There are some positives to it, but it's mainly geared toward a very small number of people who will qualify for the bill's provisions, which are mainly geared toward people that currently have no coverage or people that are in small businesses. And even there, as Donna was pointing out, there's some huge loopholes. One of the biggest problems is there's very inadequate controls on cost, which ironically was the area that they said they were going to, was their priority in the first place. It's entirely possible that people that are covered under this plan could end up paying anywhere from 10 to 19% of their incomes on insurance premiums, deductibles, copays, and other out-of-pocket costs, which is going to actually potentially increase the horrendous rise we've seen in people declaring bankruptcy as a result of medical bills or self-rationing care, not going for care when they need it. What we really, tragically, it's very late in the game right now, and what they've done is they've consistently tried to cut out advocates of single payer to the point of there were two proposals that were moving forward in the process, one of which was an amendment that was introduced by Representative Dennis Kucinich, which we strongly supported, which was actually in the House legislation until last week, which would have waived federal limitations on states like California that pass single-payer bills, as we've done twice in California, both of which have been vetoed by Governor No, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right now, if a state passes single-payer, there is a federal law which makes it, which has very federal provisions under ERISA, governing employer-sponsored health plans, which create a very great legal barrier for states to enact single-payer. The Kucinich Amendment had a waiver for those provisions to assist states that wanted to pass single-payer. So ironically, while they're talking about an opt-out for states on the public option, they wouldn't allow an opt-in for single-payer. The second provision, which was talked about in Donna's video, which you played, is an amendment being proposed by Representative Anthony Weiner from New York, which would substitute the current House bill for a single-payer bill. That is possibly going to come up for a vote within the next couple of days, and we certainly would encourage your listeners to call their representatives in Congress and urge them to support the Weiner Amendment, the Weiner Substitute Amendment, as we know it's probably not going to pass, but it's very important that it get a maximum number of votes to show support for the single-payer movement and for grassroots activists that are fighting for real, meaningful, guaranteed health care reform.
And let me ask the both of you, if people really care about this issue and they want to keep this battle going, how are you suggesting that they get involved?
I think my biggest suggestion as a patient and as somebody who's now living outside of Washington is still touch your government as closely as you can through your own representatives and your senators. Don't give up the fight for what you know is right with health care justice. I've been now in 43 states in the District of Columbia talking about health care reform, and I know without a doubt the people of this country are not the problem. The people understand it. We just have to continue to understand that we can make our government function for us. We are the ones who hire them. We are the ones who give them their benefits and the things that they enjoy at our pleasure because we vote them in and out of office. So I tell people you still can touch this government, but it takes an awful lot of us to offset that $1.4 million a day that's coming in from the health insurance lobby. You know, we could all talk forever about campaign finance reform, but that's not going to happen overnight either. So we have to get louder and more insistence. We have to say we're not going to let this happen to our neighbors, our friends, our loved ones anymore. We know that everyone getting health care is a basic human right, the way Barack Obama stated so clearly when he was a candidate. We need to support him in that, push him, make him do it, and make our other government leaders do it. You can get involved through any number of organizations. You can look on the guaranteedhealthcare.org website and find information. You can look at Healthcare Now is another good organization. Physicians for a National Health Program has a great website. There's lots of good places to get information, but get involved, make yourself heard, and keep pushing. This is not the end of the fight. It takes a long time to win these kinds of social justice battles.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Recently, a special edition of the New York Post, one of the nation's leading trashy tabloid papers, blared headlines that seemed oddly realistic for a change. The 32-page paper announced that impending doom would be faced by Americans if the U.S. did not act on climate change and industrial toxification of the earth. Down to the last detail, the fake New York Post, as it was called afterwards, was 100% true. It was another organized action by the infamous Yes Men, a small group of committed creative activists who pose as corporate executives of multinational companies and wake up their audiences by exposing the truth. Last week, the Yes Men struck hard at the heart of disaster capitalism yet again. They showed up at the Chamber of Commerce and held a parody press conference announcing a dramatic about-face in its climate policy. It would not only stop opposing the Kerry Boxer climate bill, but would work with them to make it better. The chamber has filed a civil complaint in the U.S. District Court of Washington, D.C., accusing the Yes Men of trademark infringement, unfair competition, and false advertising. The chamber's suit also lists several members of the D.C.-based activist group, the Avaaz Action Factory, as co-defendants. The conduct of those who organized the event was, quote, destructive of public discourse, the chamber argues, and that was from Mother Jones. As the Yes Men have a new film in theaters currently, The Yes Men Fix the World, the chamber also alleges that the prank was part of a, quote, comprehensive scheme to promote their movie by wrongdoing against the plaintiff, rather than an event meant to call attention to the organization's views on climate change. Joining us to talk about his work and the new film is Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men, and also with us is Antonia Juhas. She's the director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange, which works to expose the true cost of Chevron and the oil industry. She's also the author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. Andy and Antonia, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Andy, let's begin by having you explain who the Yes Men are and the latest prank you pulled on the Chamber of Commerce and what the effects have been. You've been able to call out these corporations and political entities on their destructive hypocrisies. You've essentially made a career out of it, and it's been effective. Talk about the history of the Yes Men and what led up to this latest event.
Right. Well, what we do is basically pass ourselves off as large corporations and other entities and get ourselves invited to speak at big corporate conferences or occasionally on television or, as last week, at the Washington Press Club. When we give talks as these big corporations, we like to think that what we're doing is being more honest and clearer than these entities usually are. So, for example, we gave a talk once as Halliburton, and it was at the Gulf Coast Reconstruction Conference shortly after Katrina. It was on the Gulf Coast, and it was for the insurance industry. And we basically went in there and said, if global warming proves as bad as we think it's going to be, let's not get alarmed. Let's not worry about the destruction of civilization. That can be an opportunity as long as we save the richest of the rich. And at that point, we trotted out these 6-foot diameter inflatable grub suits, basically, and showed with video and so on what they were for. They were basically for putting in them the wealthiest of the wealthy, the CEOs of the largest corporations, and making sure they can survive any climate calamity so as to be able to profit from it. And the people in the audience just kind of sat there and applauded and asked polite questions like, could they also be used against terrorism? And all of that and about 6 other episodes form the basis of our movie, The Yes Men Fix the World, which is screening at the Roxy every day, 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and so on.
That's the voice of Andy Bichlbaum. And part of your work, your prankstery, your trickery, is that you set up mirror websites of these major corporations so that television producers who maybe aren't that great at Googling or fact-checking, they Google the company's name and they get led to your website and then they book you on these television spots. Can you talk about some of the interviews that you've done posing as these corporate executives?
Yeah, back in, in 2002, actually, a friend of ours who is involved in the Bhopal struggle, the struggle to gain a compensation for the people of Bhopal. To back up a bit to 1984, a chemical plant there exploded, a chemical plant owned by Union Carbide, and 20,000 people have died over the years since the disaster. They've never been adequately compensated. The site has never been cleaned up. And in 2002, Dow Chemical bought Union Carbide, but still refuses to do anything for the victims or for the site. And so in 2002, we set up a fake website that looked like the real Dow Chemical website and sent out a little press release, got a little bit of attention. But more importantly, it got linked to in a bunch of blogs and so on. And then in 2004, when a BBC researcher was trying to get somebody from Dow to talk about the catastrophe on the 20th anniversary of the catastrophe, he stumbled on our fake site and invited us by accident onto the BBC to speak live in front of 350 million people about Dow's responsibility or not for the Bhopal catastrophe.
What'd you say?
Go ahead. On the air, we basically took full responsibility for it. We said we, Dow, are, you know, finally seeing the light. All these activists have kind of, you know, pulled the wool from our eyes, and now we see that indeed we should do the right thing, and we're compensating the victims adequately. We're dissolving Union Carbide. We're cleaning up the site. We're even going to extradite or press the U.S. government to extradite the ex-CEO of Union Carbide back to India to face the court case that he should be facing. Now, a couple things happened, as you can imagine, when we did this. One, the stock value of Dow plunged by $2 billion as long as the world thought it was true, which was about half an hour. And then as soon as the it was revealed to be a joke or not true, the stock value bounded right back up, which kind of gave us a clue about why these things happen and why companies don't do the right thing and why it doesn't really matter what CEOs think. You could convince all the CEOs in the world that they should be really, really good people and that their companies should stop doing any bad whatsoever, and it wouldn't matter because it's the stock market that determines what they do. You know, if Dow had really done the right thing in Bhopal, the CEO would have been fired for doing that, and that's what our little action proved. If the company loses money, the stockholders fire whoever's running the company. The second thing that happened, much more positive, was that there were 600 articles in the U.S. press about the prank and about Bhopal and Dow and how Dow had acquired Union Carbide but not accepted its responsibilities. And that was really the goal of the action.
That's the voice of Andy Biglebaum. He is half of the Yes Men. He's in town promoting the film, The Yes Men Fix the World. And Antonia Juhas, let's talk about these kinds of tactics in a strategic context. When you have sit-ins and marches and legit protests scheduled at certain times and permitted by the cities, that's one way to do it. Andy and Mike of the Yes Men have another tactic, another way of doing things. Can you talk about the importance of creative nonviolent civil disobedience and good old-fashioned trickster strategies that can influence or completely change policies, especially when it comes to challenging corporations like Chevron?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what we need is absolutely every tool under our belt, and the Yes Men came up with, you know, have come up with an unbelievably unique model that is astounding, that it continues to be so incredibly successful. You know, the audience that they're able to reach, unique audience they're able to reach with this sort of profound aha moments, utilizing each of their tactics, all of their different tactics, is, you know, amazing. And when you combine that with different models of civil disobedience and traditional models of protest, you also get an astounding combination. We're combining, and we have combined with the Yes Men on targeting Chevron, creating amazing street theater, getting the entire audience at the Roxy to protest, after the Yes Men film, being led by Chevron executives in these survivor balls, being dragged up 16th Street by Chevron minions in hazmat suits, and bringing hundreds of people to a Chevron station to stage a protest, you know, brings all kinds of new people into the mix. It attacks Chevron's brand, which is so critical for Chevron. It makes so many more people ask questions. It brings media and spreads virally in a way that you don't otherwise. And, you know, we have to be so creative now with providing new streams of our own sources of media, new video that will spread, new stories that will spread, new activism that will bring in new people. And, you know, my motto is always, you know, bring in all the tactics and blend them together to create, you know, really not only powerful vehicles, but vehicles that attract more people to activism, bring more people into activism.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Within the last few hours, the U.S. Congress voted to condemn the Richard Goldstone report, the results of an investigation by the United Nations into war crimes committed by the Israeli government and its military against Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip earlier this year. Goldstone, a South African former Supreme Court judge, along with his investigators, found that Israel is responsible for a myriad of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and its officials should be investigated at the International Court of Justice. The congressional resolution, introduced by Representative Ileana Ross-Lehtinen of Florida, urges the Obama administration to quash the Goldstone report from, quote, advancing any further. Here's Representative Dennis Kucinich.
Today we journey from Operation Cast Lead to Operation Cast Doubt. Almost as serious as committing war crimes is covering up war crimes, pretending that war crimes were never committed and did not exist. Because behind every such deception is the nullification of humanity, the destruction of human dignity, the annihilation of the human spirit, the triumph of Orwellian thinking, the eternal prison of the dark heart of the totalitarian. The resolution before us today, which would reject all attempts of the Goldstone Report to fix responsibility to all parties to war crimes, including both Hamas and Israel, may as well be called the down is up, night is day, wrong is right resolution. Because if this Congress votes to condemn a report it has not read concerning events it has totally ignored about violations of law of which it is unaware, it will have brought shame to this great institution. How can we ever expect there to be peace in the Middle East if we tacitly approve of violations of international law and international human rights, if we look the other way, or if we close our eyes to the heartbreak of people on both sides by whitewashing a legitimate investigation? How can we protect the people of Israel from existential threat if we hold no concern for the protection of Palestinians, for their physical security, their right to land, their right to own homes, their right to water, their right to sustenance, their right to freedom of movement, their right to human security of jobs, education, and health care? We will have peace only when the plight of both Palestinians and Israelis is brought before this House and given equal consideration in recognition of the principle that all people on this planet have a right to survive and thrive, and it is our responsibility, our duty, to see that no individual, no group, no people are barred from this humble human claim.
That was Dennis Kucinich, Democratic congressman from Ohio, earlier today in the U.S. Congress. For many activists, organizers, and members of communities that stand in solidarity with Palestinian human rights, this congressional declaration against the Goldstone Report is one more measure of injustice against Palestinians who face expanded occupation and land theft, colonization, and subjugation by the Israeli state. And behind this act, of course, keeping the gears moving are the pro-Israeli Zionist lobbies, namely AIPAC. But what about the emerging so-called alternative to AIPAC, the new J Street lobby? Do they represent a real alternative to AIPAC's ideologies and strategies? Joining us to talk about this is Josh Healy. Recently, Healy and his colleague Kevin Koval, Jewish American poets and activists, were invited to the annual J Street conference in Washington, D.C., and then subsequently disinvited, they say, because of their views on Palestine and equal human rights. Josh also works with Youth Speaks here in the Bay Area. Josh, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me, Noor. This is the question, obviously, what is to be done? And it's interesting. I think what you saw at J Street was a couple things. I think you saw people energized and feeling that there is change that's possible. I also think you saw a slight bit of a generational shift in that at the student conference, and this is information that, you know, I've talked to students, and what they told me was, and it's been in the media since, is the students decided to drop the label pro-Israel and just stay pro-peace. Because what they said is, although we are for the long-term interests of Israelis and Palestinians, when you say the words pro-Israel, it does not automatically come off as a progressive position. And so rather than try to reclaim that, which some people are doing, they said, we're going to just be pro-peace. And what that means is we're pro-Palestinian rights and we're pro-Israeli people who are supporting peace and human rights. But we're not pro-one government. To be pro-one government is just blinding yourself to the facts. And so what I think you're seeing is you have groups that, you know, J Street is doing some things. Here in the Bay Area, you have groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, like Tikkun, like the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. You have great groups locally. And I think that work does need to be done within our community, because I do think we need that space to speak. But I also think sometimes we get a little too internal looking, and we need to build with our brothers, build with our sisters, specifically with Palestinians, specifically with Arabs. but also with all Americans, because it's all of our tax dollars that are going to support really, really murderous policies.
We want to give you a chance to read some of your poetry, your banned poetry, your censored poetry that got you disinvited from the annual J Street Conference.
Thank you for having me on Flashpoints. It's an honor. So this is the poem specifically that came up in a bunch of right-wing blogs and was sent to J Street, and they were scared, and they succumbed to really what I call McCarthyism straight up, and they disinvited me as well as a couple other poets and presenters because of specifically this poem. I'm in D.C. on my way to march against Israeli occupation. I get off the red line at Judiciary Square, and the first thing I see are two middle-aged white women wearing matching black tank tops with pink letters across their chest that read, "Two moms are hotter than one." Apparently, the Palestinian Solidarity March has been placed right across the street from the Gay Pride Parade. It's clear as the Dead Sea who is going to which. Kafiyas and peace signs to the left, leather boots and nipple tassels to the right. Four lanes divide the crowds, but have no power to stop the two sound systems from becoming one explosion of noise. So on the left, it's "Free, free Palestine," and then "Gay liberation now," and "Free, free Palestine, gay liberation now," and then "Free Palestine now," and "Gay liberation Palestine," and finally "Free gay Palestine, free gay Palestine, free gay Palestine." And I imagine Mahmoud Abbas, prime minister turned minister, performing the first marriage in liberated Ramallah and pronouncing the two new citizens happy husband and husband, while Ellen DeGeneres and the Human Rights Campaign stage a hunger strike outside the UN to demand the LGBT right of return. And I wonder if we can build a queer intifada, what other coalitions are possible. But I am here. And I am straight and Jewish, white and American. Solidarity is not just my offering at the movement dinner table. It's the first invitation I got to sit down and eat. But I remember the stay at Ellis Island when I was hungry myself. And I remember the same day German soldiers forced my family to wear yellow triangles. They forced pink ones on my friends, and Frank is Matthew Shepard. Guantanamo is Auschwitz, gay marriage is Palestine, and we are all standing on occupied land. The protesters are shouting their final chants now. I start making my way back to the metro, see a young woman walking on the other side of the street. She is wearing a hijab, body covered from the knees up except her face and hands, toned like olive trees. In her left palm waves a small, but unmistakable rainbow flag. It is June in D.C. The moon is rising early in the evening sky, not a crescent, not a rainbow. The moon is full tonight, full and bright and marching ever higher.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.